on unemployment, some good news, and a warning.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This is the Morning Report for Thursday, April 1st at Marketplace.org. I'm Bill Radke. This morning we got news and some commentary on America's job outlook. We'll tell you what it all means in a moment. First, where's Wall Street? Stock market is waking up perky this morning. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ are both up almost 1%, and the Dow is 83 points higher at 10,939. Overseas, there was some good news on manufacturing in Europe. Shares there are up almost 1%, and signs of growing strength in China and Japan helped Asian stocks zoom more than 1% today. Let's say a good morning to Bill Stone, Chief Investment Strategist at PNC Wealth Management. He comes to us live from Philadelphia. Morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So the U.S. government gives us its official unemployment report tomorrow. This morning, our Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, gets on NBC's Today Show and says he's, quote, very worried about unemployment, which he said will stay, quote, unacceptably high for a very long time. Should I be scared?
Well, I think he's probably right that it will stay high. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if you saw unemployment actually tick up a little bit in the report tomorrow. That doesn't necessarily mean that things are getting worse. The thing to really watch is what we call the non-farm payrolls, which measures the amount of jobs either added or subtracted from the economy. Unemployment rate has another variable, which is the number of people really looking for jobs. So it tends to actually sometimes go up a little bit when things actually start to get better, believe it or not.
Okay, and we got a little news this morning. The weekly look at unemployment claims came out. The number of new claims fell a little bit. But I want to talk about Asia now. I mentioned the report on manufacturing in China, business confidence in Japan. Could it be that we are not in as much trouble as we thought because a rising Asia lifts us all?
I think you're right. I think a lot of it is a support, let's call it hopefully an all-out global recovery. Even it's worth mentioning that Japan had some better-than-expected news, and it's been a while since we've been able to say those words.
Right. Bill Stone at PNC Wealth Management, we hope you're right. Happy April, and thanks.
Thank you, you too.
We were talking about unemployment there. Even many people, though, who have jobs are finding it harder to get ahead, and that includes executives. A new survey out this morning finds executive paychecks at the 200 biggest U.S. companies fell about 1% in 2009, and that's on top of a 3.5% drop in 2008. And turns out this is very unusual. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joins us live. Good morning, Mitchell.
Good morning, Bill.
Is this the recession effect reaching all the way to the corner office?
You know, I suppose you could say so. This is the second year in a row pays down. Before that, it hadn't fallen for 20 years. Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank in London, though, predicts the long-term trend is still likely to be up.
Companies are looking more at executive compensation and saying, well, is this defensible? And it is no longer quite the same old boys network as it used to be. But I do think these are guys who have very substantial egos. They are monitored by other people who have very substantial egos, and nobody really wants to be deemed to be average. So there's always a little bit of upward pressure.
So, Mitchell, whose paycheck is up and whose is down?
Well, according to the survey, which was done for the Wall Street Journal, the top earner last year was Occidental Petroleum's Ray Irani. He got $52 million in salary bonus and stock. Next, Disney's Robert Iger at $21 million. The median CEO income here was $6.9 million. At the bottom, Dish Network CEO Charles Ergen. His pay fell more than 90% to $623,000.
Tragic. Can we assume, Mitchell, that everybody connected to Wall Street is doing worse?
No, not at all. Move down the street to the hedge fund headquarters. It's a different story. The magazine Absolute Return just ranked hedge fund managers. Top 25 earners made significantly more last year, $25 billion all told.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman. Mitchell, thank you.
You're welcome.
Later today, the federal government will announce new fuel efficiency standards for cars. For the first time, those standards also include limits on greenhouse gas emissions. The rules will apply to all new cars from next year on. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Brett Neely reports.
After years of fighting, the auto industry agreed to tougher standards last year. By 2016, new cars will have to get an average of 34 miles per gallon of gas, up from 26 miles per gallon today. The Environmental Protection Agency rules will set stricter standards for car air conditioners, too, says David Friedman at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
The air conditioners in our cars and trucks leak, and the gases that they leak out have more than 1,000 times the impact on global warming as do the carbon dioxide emissions that come out of your tailpipe when you burn gasoline.
But efficiency comes at a cost. The EPA estimates the rules could add $1,300 to the price of a new car. Call it a Cadillac tax.
The larger the footprint of the automobile, and I mean literally the size of the car, or the more difficult it will be for them to meet that the auto efficiency standard, and so you might well expect a difference in price depending on the size of the car.
Scott Siegel is an energy lobbyist for the law firm Bracewell & Giuliani. He says today's announcement is the first exercise of the EPA's new powers over greenhouse gases. Starting next year, big polluters like refineries and power plants will have to clean up their act. Industry may wind up paying more, but David Friedman says consumers will come out ahead.
We've estimated that the day you drive off the lot, you will be saving more money on gasoline than you'll be paying in increased loan payments for your car.
And he says all that money saved is money not spent on foreign oil. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
German and French banks are reacting today to proposed bank taxes. There are similar ideas here in the States. The Obama administration's looking to impose its own bank tax later this year. Christopher Wirth has the story.
In Germany, government officials want a levy to raise $1.5 billion to help bail out banks in coming years. But under a German plan, only banks would pay a tax. Today, the French finance minister says in that country, hedge funds should also be subject to a levy. Richard Portis is with the London Business School. He says France can go after hedge funds all at once. It won't make a difference.
Who cares whether the French tax hedge funds? No major hedge funds are based in France. The hedge funds are based in the UK and Switzerland and the United States. This is just not a serious point.
In the U.S., the tax would target banks with over $50 billion in assets to ensure that taxpayer money is paid back for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or the bailout known as TARP. But Portis says instead of bank levies, governments should cut big banks down to size and place tighter controls on the kind of risky behavior that lead to bailouts in the first place. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Pepsi announced this week it is racing to find new natural zero-calorie sweeteners, something that might help it get around a possible tax on sugary beverages. State and federal lawmakers are considering imposing a tax in the near future. But as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports, not everyone believes that idea would have the desired effect.
A study out this morning from the RAND Corporation doesn't quarrel with the idea that a national sugary beverage tax would bring in money. But RAND senior economist Roland Sturm says a 3-5% tax wouldn't convince people, especially kids, to cut back.
It's not the magic bullet.
He says a larger tax, maybe 20%, would be needed. And it would work best, he says, if it made the price of the product on the shelf look much more expensive than other drinks.
This tax would have to be visible. If the goal is not just to raise money, but the goal is to change consumption, then consumers need to be clearly aware of it.
As you might expect, the industry is fighting hard against the idea. Here's Kelly Brownell, who directs Yale's Center on Food Policy and Obesity.
I've never seen the industry respond so negatively to any proposal, which proves to me two things. One is that it's politically feasible, otherwise why would they worry about it? And second is that they believe it would really affect consumption.
Brownell says a national sugary beverage tax would bring in $15 billion a year. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
50 years ago today, the U.S. government launched its first successful weather satellite, TIROS-1. It captured never-before-seen images of weather from above and beamed them back to Earth. The government gave that data to anybody who wanted it. And eventually, businesses like the Weather Channel were able to use it to beam down profits. As Sabri Benashour reports, other businesses are looking to capitalize as more and more government information becomes public.
160 years ago, newspapers would lift weather observations from the Smithsonian Institution, call it a weather page, and call it a day. These days, weather data is still free, but it's data. Endless, seemingly incomprehensible streams of it. So if you're going to hang a business model on it, you have to jazz it up a little. If you're the Weather Channel, you got to, I don't know, throw a reporter into a hurricane.
It's very hard to stand here. Just the power of the hurricane.
But more importantly, you have to add value. Bruce Rose is vice president of the Weather Channel.
I mean, we have a lot of proprietary systems and a lot of intellectual property, a lot of secret sauce that goes into producing the weather forecast after processing the raw data.
Carl Malamud runs publicresource.org, a group whose mission is to make government data more accessible. He says government data streams have multiplied, and businesses that tap into them number in the tens of thousands.
I think it's pervasive. You know, it's like saying how many companies use roads.
Malamud points to stockbrokers who use data from the Securities and Exchange Commission, Hollywood filmmakers who use government footage, and mapping services that start with free GPS from the military. And he says you don't have to be a big business to get in on the act.
And it's becoming much easier with the decrease in disk space costs and computing power and internet bandwidth for a small startup to do something with it.
Easier, yes, but also more competitive. Take that example of online mapping services. Now you have free Google Maps that make money on ads, and just plain free Wiki Maps. To make money, startups have to come up with a niche. Ian White is behind startup Urban Mapping.
If you wanted to ask a question and say, find me the parts of the United States that are within 1 mile of a transit station, had a 60% or higher voter turnout, and are in a poorly performing school district, we can tell you that information on the fly.
And with the upcoming census figures, new healthcare data, and increased government openness, there are only more business opportunities to come. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Before William Faulkner wrote The Sound and the Fury, he was a mailman. He didn't pay much, but he got to read the magazines he was delivering. The day jobs of famous authors is the subject of a piece in Lapham's Quarterly, a journal of history and ideas founded by longtime Harper's Magazine editor Lewis Lapham. Lewis, welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you, Bill.
And why are day jobs interesting to you?
They're interesting because it's very rare that people can support themselves simply on their writing. Faulkner, as you say, was a postmaster at the University of Mississippi. He was a terrible postmaster.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
He lost the mail. He spent the afternoons playing mahjong and sometimes going on a round of golf.
Charlotte Bronte worked for almost nothing, and apparently she didn't have time to write either.
No, she didn't. She was a governess, and she was being paid $1,800 a year.
That's today's equivalent money.
Yeah, that's today's equivalent. We're talking about the middle of the 19th century, and she had to pay extra to wash her clothes.
Do you think today's modern authors are more or less able to support themselves with their writing?
Well, very few. I mean, if you look at the record, I mean, most writers today have some kind of university affiliation or a foundation grant.
How is the recession affecting writers?
It might make them see more clearly what kind of society that they're living in. A lot of the writing in the United States for the last 20-odd years has been very self-absorbed, the memoir instead of the portrait of the society. It might encourage writers to engage more with the society as a whole. It might force them to look more carefully at other people.
Lewis Lapham is editor of Lapham's Quarterly. Lewis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Here's an industry that's doing okay. For-profit colleges like DeVry. Enrollment is up at those schools, despite some negative attention from regulators and the media. The colleges are answering their critics today with a new study of their own, as Amy Scott tells us from the Marketplace Education Desk.
For-profit schools have been criticized for their aggressive recruiting and high costs. Mark Pelish is with Corinthian Colleges, one of the largest for-profits. To fight back, he says Corinthian commissioned a study.
We thought it was important to get some real data that was rigorously put together to help frame a better, more accurate view of the sector.
Pelish says data from the Department of Education show that for-profit schools graduate a higher percentage of students than community colleges. Gail Mello is president of LaGuardia Community College in Queens. She says problems with data make it hard to compare schools.
But I think the thing you can compare is what it costs students and the kind of debt load students leave the colleges with.
Mello says a two-year degree in electronics and computer technology cost more than $42,000 at the for-profit DeVry College of New York. At her school, it would be just over $6,000. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And finally, you could fly nonstop from New York to Paris on the first weekend in May for $1,100, or you could fly from New York to Omaha for $1,400 to attend Berkshire Hathaway's annual shareholder meeting, the meeting that Berkshire Chairman Warren Buffett calls Woodstock for capitalists. Bloomberg News reports airlines have jacked up fares to Omaha that weekend because of the demand. One fund manager who attends every Berkshire meeting put it this way, quote, "Omaha is where all the action is. Why would you ever want to be in Paris on May 1st?
I love
Omaha.
Paris. Why do I love
Omaha?
Paris? Because my
Warren Buffett
is here.
This is the Marketplace Morning Report. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
I love Paris every moment.
American Public Media.
This is a big weekend coming up for college basketball, the Division I Final Four. But for community college players, every day is a big day.
The guys that we go after are the guys that have already screwed up. And so when we first get them in the door, it's like, hey, look, this is your second chance.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. March Madness is spreading next time on Marketplace from American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.